Welcome to Oncology Today, the management of ovarian cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Bradley Monk from the University of Arizona College of Medicine. In addition to this audio podcast, there's also a corresponding video program with Dr. Monk's slide presentation. To begin, Dr. Monk discussed the patient from his practice. Why don't we just begin with your cases and we'll just sort of see where it leads.
So they, you know, it's the way I have so many patients that I didn't have this in mind when I wrote it, but this patient, this is a PALA-1 patient, and my last PALA-1 start today was Wednesday, is Monday. So, I mean, I just roll through these and we have a whole packet. Because when I do genetic testing, the last thing I want to do is send her to a genetic counselor. I want to counsel her right there, right then, in the clinic, and get the ball rolling. Me and my staff, we're well equipped. We have literature, we have a consent, so we test them right there. This patient that I saw Monday, mid-50s, her sister had just got diagnosed with breast cancer and was BRCA positive, when I say just 3 or 4 months ago, and she hadn't got around to it. Right? Everybody thinks they're different, but you know, life is a full-time job, as I always say. And you know, we have to control what we can control. And one thing that we can control is our, you know, doing genetic testing and understanding our family history. And if there is a chance of a genetic mutation, that we get tested and then do risk-reducing surgery or active surveillance. And she missed it. I'm not sure 3 or 4 months would have made a difference.
So you saw her the first time on Monday. She's in her 50s. Her sister had breast cancer a few months ago, found out she was BRCA. She held off on being tested or doing anything about it. How did she present? She had symptoms?
Yeah, so there's sort of two ways that ovarian cancers present. One is they sort of have sort of low-grade symptoms, and they go to the OBGYN doctor. And the OBGYN doctor does a scan or an exam and says, you know, go see your local gyn-onc. My sense, and it may be my practice pattern, that that's probably only a third of patients. The more typical patient is they're just full of ovarian cancer. They don't know what's going on, whether they're putting on weight or why they can't eat or they're nauseated, and they go to the ER. And in every ER almost in America, there's a CAT scanner. And there you go. So that's exactly what happened to this woman. So she had no idea she might have ovarian cancer. And so I got a call from the ER and they said, hey, this woman has ovarian cancer. You want us to put her in the hospital? I said, no. Okay, no. Let's draw a CA125 and some other tumor markers. I generally do a CEA in 19-9 right then and send her to see me. And I actually intercepted her before she got to my office. So she needs a core biopsy. I can pull the CAT scan up online. In the olden days, we do a cytology examination, but now we do a core biopsy. We need the tissue for HRD testing. It's really important. And we don't just do a core. My radiologists, they have a little sheath and they can do sort of 12. It's really great. So they get all this gobs of tissue. And someday, right, someday we're going to do a folate receptor alpha on that, right? Someday we're going to do a NaPi2b on that as the biomarker landscape evolves. For now, we're doing somatic BRCA and HRD, but only if they're germline BRCA. So when I saw her in the office on Monday, I did her germline, and I told her if that's normal, I won't analyze the tissue that was just done. Because sometimes you give the neoadjuvant chemotherapy and the tumor goes away. Which is a great thing, obviously, because those patients have an easier operation and they're more sensitive to PARP inhibition. It's the platinum sensitivity in addition to the molecular signature predicts activity. So if you have a patient frontline that doesn't really respond to platinum, maybe a little bit, even if she's HRD, it's not going to be that great.
So you see this woman, you have tissue available, but you also have a germline BRCA cooking. And when you see her on Monday, anything on physical exam and what did her imaging show?
Yeah, she looks like she's pregnant. And you wonder how she's been walking away that way, right? And she has a fixed pelvic mass. Again, this is just very, very common. And, you know, we have a whole process where they just, you know, this plug and play. And so we don't And again, my style, because I say, go through the contraindications to bevacizumab. Have you had diverticulitis? Do you have inflammatory bowel disease? Okay. Looking for non-healing wounds, unstable VTE, arterial thrombosis, proteinuria, kidney disease. And if she doesn't have any of that, she'll get started on bevacizumab, carboplatin paclitaxel, carboplatin AUC of 6, paclitaxel 175, the very first cycle. And she'll get Bev cycles 1 and 2. We'll reassess her with physical exam, CAT scan, CA125 around the third cycle or so. We'll do the interval debulking. There's a lot of coordination, literally about 24 to 5 days after the third cycle. Remember, you'd give it every 21 days. So you don't want to do it in 4 or 5 weeks because the tumor grows back. You want to just do it just so her bone marrow can recover. And then you bring her in. And then you have to start the chemotherapy about 3 weeks after the debulking surgery. If you don't synchronize and coordinate this, the tumor just grows back. So we sort of have a process, works very well. And then ultimately in the maintenance phase, if she's HRD or BRCA, we add a olaparib, away we roll. And if for some reason the bevacizumab stops, for some reason, maybe there's a problem, hypertension, proteinuria, then we would say, okay, now if you're not HRD, then we can give you niraparib.
You were going through the algorithm that you just kind of described also. What are the situations where you don't use neoadjuvant therapy? You go directly to surgery.
Yeah. So again, you get immediate feedback when you do it. Okay. And you also have to have the capability to start chemotherapy, as I already said, in 3 weeks, maybe 4. If you're doing primary debulking and you start chemotherapy weeks 5, 6, and 7, you shouldn't have done the operation. The cancer grows back. And people don't really realize that. So the situation is that they have to have resectable disease. And the CAT scan, I look at CAT scans almost every day. CAT scan is as good as a laparoscopy, maybe better. I can see exactly where the tumor is. And you have to make an assessment of the fitness of the patient. So you have to be able to get it out, get away with it, meaning she's not going to go to the ICU for a week. And then you have to get her to chemotherapy at 3 to 4 weeks. And you're like, wow, that sounds tough. And you're right. And that's why 60 to 70% of patients with advanced ovarian cancer get neoadjuvant. And there are people that have big knives, diaphragmatic resections. It's just not evidence-based.
So moving on to the next point in terms of choice of PARP inhibitor in a patient, for example, with a BRCA mutation, which sounds like that's most likely what you're going to see with this lady.
Yep.
How do you decide? You have the PRIMA data, you have the SOLO-1 data, you have olaparib, you have niraparib. But another thing about that, and I don't know whether this enters into your decision or how you handle it, it's just the duration of treatment was different in those two trials. It was 2 years with olaparib and 3 years with niraparib. Are those the durations that you use? And in a situation, for example, BRCA germline, how do you decide between the two?
Yeah. So the PRIMA trial had 3 years in the study. It was taken out of the label. So the duration of niraparib is no longer in the label because there were so few patients beyond 2 to 3 years. And in olaparib and SOLO-1 was 2 years. So now the label is silent as to what the duration of niraparib should be. So what do I do practically? It's really about a 2-year duration because this mature SOLO-1 data show that when you stop the olaparib, there's not all of a sudden all these recurrences. But you will run into a patient who is at the 2-year mark, let's say with niraparib, and she says, look, Monk, this is keeping me alive and I feel just fine, and I why would I stop? And so that you kind of got to make the decision together with the patient, but it's really a 2-year regimen at its core. I want to address the other question because I'm going to surprise you what my answer is, I bet. So there are some scenarios where there are overlapping indications. So germline BRCA, not on Bev, you can give niraparib or SOLO-1, olaparib. And that's the easiest decision ever, ever. And here's the answer. And same for platinum-sensitive maintenance. Platinum-sensitive maintenance, y'all got all three. So ARIEL-3, rucaparib, SOLO-2, study-19, olaparib, and NOVA-niraparib. And it's the same answer. It's the easiest question ever. You use the one with the lowest copay. End of discussion. And so the copays are generally substantially different. So I'll walk out of the room. Let's say platinum sensitive maintenance. If I see a PARP naive patient, she's responding, and I'll say, this woman needs PARP maintenance. We got three options. And it's my experience that the copays are a magnitude of difference in the range of $300-$400 versus $1,200. Really? Really? You want to use the $1,200 when the efficacy endpoints are very similar? You cannot distinguish. Okay. And now with niraparib, the personalized dose, you can't say that niraparib is substantially more toxic. So what really matters is the financial aspects of it. And that's, it's really a no-brainer. And when I say that to people, they're like, yeah, that makes sense. So this is important also, because when you say that, you begin to put pressure on pharma to begin to be more price conscious. And the biggest problem that we have with all the things that I'm doing, at least, is I develop medicines that cost $10,000 a dose. And now in cervical cancer, as you know, in first-line cervical cancer, patients are getting bevacizumab and pembrolizumab, $20,000 a cycle. And so we need generics. They will come. Biosimilars will come. But we can't get there soon enough because the financial toxicity is substantial.
That's very interesting. Let me ask you, do you see, you know, some payers who will have a higher copay for laparib and other payers higher
all the time
for niraparib?
Routinely.
So different.
Routinely.
Wow. That is very interesting.
Yeah. They're almost never the same.
Very interesting. Another question and scenario that just so much debate about is the HR proficient situation. And as you brought up in your talk, you know, if you already have the patient on Bev, you know, you can keep the Bev going. You know, that kind of makes that straightforward. But what about the situation where Bev is not on board in the HR proficient situation, where I guess you're looking at either niraparib or nothing, right?
Correct. How do you make that decision? It's tough, I think. But, you know, most patients want to invest in the small benefit. The beauty of it is, and so I like Bev, that's my disclosure. But during the pandemic, we gave less of it because we had the opportunity to give niraparib where patients could get it at home, telemedicine, they get their labs at home, and I'd have patients on PARP inhibitors that I wouldn't see for 9, 10, 11 months. I'd see them like I'm seeing you today, but that was really good. This idea of having to come for bevacizumab, you know, the beauty of pembrolizumab, as you know, is pivoted to every 6 weeks. So bevacizumab never did that. So you have to keep marching every 3 weeks. I'm not a fan of saying to the woman, look, the biology of your tumor is so poor that PARP inhibitors are not going to work well. So we're just going to do nothing. Yeah, it's not what they want to hear. I do set the expectation. And I saw another patient on Monday. I said, look, you know, the reason that we're talking about your platinum-sensitive progression on Bev. So she had niraparib and she was HRP and it didn't work very well. And then she got a platinum doublet with Bev, which is sort of the standard. And now she's progressing on her chemotherapy bevacizumab. And I said, you know, I used to kind of wonder why this happened. I know exactly why this happened. And I explained to her in lay terms that her tumor is homologous recombination proficient. And so the niraparib didn't work. The re-challenge with platinum didn't work, and we didn't get lucky with bevacizumab, and she's going to die. And so the best treatment for her is the clinical trials that I described. So we're going to now screen her for the clinical trials, just what I said, maybe antibody drug conjugates, which are not DNA damaging agents and not anti-angiogenics, work through a different mechanism. Mm-hmm.
So in terms of assays, also, you've mentioned the HRD and LOH. Could you go through a little bit more in terms of kind of how you explain to fellows what they're actually doing the assay for and what the implications of these assays are? And also, any thoughts about the other things you see on tissue assays like NGH, for example, other mutations, also on the germline, PALB2, you know, the whole sequence of things, ATM, et cetera. And, you know, sort of putting aside, you know, sort of ability to get it paid for, from your point of view, how do you pick that out? And the other thing that you went through in your talk that I thought was so interesting is, as you say, you know, people kind of don't necessarily get so excited about HR proficient tumors. But yet, if you look at the hazard rate and you look at that separately, yeah, it's not as good as BRCA, but it's not that bad. It's like about 0.5.
Exactly.
We're seeing all kinds of things getting approved for 0.7 nowadays. So 0.5, to me, when I saw it, and it's the same exact thing you saw with recurrent disease. So to me, that's a pretty good hazard rate. Anyhow, what about the assay and its implications?
Yeah, so the way I explain it is that the PARP damages the DNA, and if your DNA has trouble with repairing those defects, the cells will die. And I can see sort of how well your DNA is maintained. And if your DNA is not maintained very well, in other words, there's lots of scars, and you know what a scar is, the DNA has been challenged with damage. So that's a pretty simple concept. The issue is, though, is it's, you know, it doesn't change. So if you have a patient who's had three or four lines of therapy, she could be HRD, but it really doesn't reflect the biology. So we need functional assays. The next point, you said panel germline testing. They have 35 genes, and it's the same cost as if you just get BRCA. So you order a panel of germline genes, you get all of them, the Lynch syndromes, the RAD51s, and so on. So it's pretty easy to get it done. In the tumor, the gene mutations are not nearly as impactful as the genomic scarring assays. So the homologous recombination repair gene mutations in the tumor, I just ignore it. So if there's a BRIP1, but she's not HRD, she's not HRD. And that BRIP1 or RAD51C mutation doesn't change my mind. The assessment of PARP sensitivity is the HRD assay. And as you know, we have different types of ovarian cancer. This idea that you're going to do next-gen sequencing in a high-grade serous tumor and that you're going to get an ALK or an EGF or a ROS or a RET, really? Okay. It's very different with the rarer histologies in the clear cell and the endometrioid, and even in the low-grade serous where KRAS is important. So we still may send, I still may send a high-grade serous just to check the box, but there's never anything there. But when you begin to take that clear cell cancer, that mucinous tumor, and you send it for next-gen sequencing, you may say, hey, look at that TMB. That TMB is 25, okay? Or that patient has a HER mutation. Right. And you do breast cancer, all the HER2 sort of, you know, the drug conjugates, the TKIs, the re-engineered antibodies, as you know, are really sensational. So we like that. People will say, well, maybe the high grade serous tumor, there might be an opportunity for a clinical trial, but it's exceptionally rare. So we do it, but I'm hoping generally for these serous, clear cell, mucinous, low grade serous tumors, I'm going to find something, and we do all the time. And I think that KRAS is important in low-grade serous as an example, although we're testing that.
You know, it's been pretty interesting since the ASCO meeting in June where they put out the Olympia trial in breast cancer, now bringing up olaparib into adjuvant and neoadjuvant. Now, all of a sudden, in breast cancer, we're talking about, and of course, the issue of testing is a huge issue as well. But I mean, just out of curiosity, if you have somebody with a PALB2 mutation, will you try to get olaparib up front?
If she's HRD, I will. I just don't let it factor into the equation.
Wow, really interesting.
We've learned from the aerial studies that you really have to look at LOH. If you look at Eric Pujada-Rain, his paper from Paula, he did that. He did just that. He looked from Paula 1 to see if HRR genes really was as good as or better. They didn't show that the HRR genetic mutations is really as impactful. So that's a misnomer.
So you also brought up the issue of Bev and the Paola study, and also curious how you make that decision in terms of assays. Do you, again, take the HR approach if it's positive and they're on Bev, you bring in olaparib?
If they're HRD, yes, and they're on Bev, olaparib, it's a no-brainer. And I set that expectation in the beginning. So when I say, look, I'm going to start you on bevacizumab, you're going to get this during the chemotherapy and in maintenance, and we're going to do some tests to see if olaparib will work for you. And if it is, we're really excited and we're going to do it.
So one other thing, I did want to bring up the issue of survival, because this comes out in all oncology trials, particularly the earlier, the more they talk about it. And we now have follow-up data 5 years with SOLO-1.
Yeah. So it's a 2-to-1 randomization. So only a third of the patients, not a half, are in the placebo arm, right? And the patients on olaparib are not dying. That's why there's no data, because it's an event-driven analysis. I'm pretty excited about it. And I'm already convinced. And I think most people are convinced. So as I said, I'm not really that excited about it because I'm already sold. It's the settings where in Europe, particularly, where the payers need that survival advantage to provide reimbursement. You know, that's the difference, right? When we get FDA approval, we get general broad reimbursement typically. But in Europe, you know, reimbursement is inconsistent. And the use of medications over and over again, for example, in Europe, you can't use bevacizumab after bevacizumab. And let's just take Canada. In Canada, GOG-218 frontline bevacizumab is not approved. So you can only use bevacizumab in Canada in platinum-resistant disease. So the setting, the reimbursement, the indication is very, very important. And it's tough to keep straight, quite frankly. Monday, I was in clinic again, and the pharmacist comes in and says, you know, patients on olaparib bevacizumab in platinum-sensitive maintenance, I can't get it approved. I said, I know, because that's a frontline regimen. And I said, you know, I admire my esteemed colleagues of wanting to do it in platinum-sensitive maintenance, but it's not approved, and that's why you can't get it paid for. And there you go. And she's like, the pharmacist is like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. PALA-1. And I said, yeah, that's what the one stands for. PALA-1, first line. Yeah.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about tolerability. I'm kind of curious. Patients are so overwhelmed and at that this time in their life, and you're trying to kind of get through the key messages to them. When you start a patient on a PARP inhibitor, what are some of the key things you emphasize to them?
So I try to build confidence. And what I say is, look, you know, I got two jobs. I got to keep you alive, and I got to keep you feeling well. I got to do both at the same time. I say, I don't tolerate, you know, toxicity and side effects. So if we can agree on that, then we can move forward. The second thing is that I can't work on a side effect that I don't know about. So if you're sick from a side effect of a treatment and you stay home because you don't want to bother me, it's on you. It's not on me. And so my job, though, is to be accessible. And so this is how you have access to me so I can know about it and be a man of my word and not tolerate adverse reactions. And then the third thing I say is that it's not a failure to dose reduce. So we start all patients on the same dose, even if it's 200, all patients like you on the same dose. And it may be too much, okay? And if we need to stop to get over your nausea, let's say, then we would accept that and it would be okay. And then I also have my advanced practice providers provide some supportive care. So for example, with niraparib, if niraparib should be taken at night, it's once daily, with a small meal, and if there's any hint of insomnia or any hint of nausea, should be taken with a small dose, let's say, of olanzapine, okay? So you can take a small meal, your 200 of niraparib, a little of olanzapine, you're gonna get a good night's rest, okay? So she's going to be refreshed in the morning. It's short acting, okay? And the intestinal irritation is probably a major contributor to the nausea. It's not at the chemotactic trigger zone. It's sort of local irritation. So I set that expectation, and away we roll. So most patients, as I said, about 2/3 of the patients on olaparib can maintain full dose. The other thing, as I explain over time, because I see them lots of times, is I say, you know, we're going to get in a groove here. And it may take a number of months to sort of get in the steady state. And once patients are in the groove, it's all fine. So you just kind of find that sweet spot. And as far as monitoring, I get it that niraparib is unique because you have to check the blood pressure once a week in the first month. And that niraparib is unique because you also check the blood counts. We just do it for all the PARP inhibitors. So I ask my patients to always check their blood pressure. Sometimes it's low because they're dehydrated. So that's best practice. I have them check their labs once a week for the first month. And the other rucaparib, as you know, has an LFT. So I do check the trend. You know, we do a CMP rather than a basic metabolic panel every month looking for that. And so it, you have to sort of create these order sets. And so that you don't want a different order set for a different PARP inhibitor. You put them all together. And it's the same thing with our checkpoint inhibitors. I don't manage adverse reactions of the seven FDA-approved checkpoint inhibitors any different.
So any comments about cytopenias and GI toxicity? You sort of alluded to it, but how often do you see this being a major problem where you can't really, you don't really control it well with dose reduction? Do you end up using transfusions? Do you use preemptive GI medications? Any comments about these two tolerability issues?
First of all, ondansetron is a terrible medication chronically because of the constipation. So don't ever use it. You know, you want to use either a dopaminergic such as olanzapine or even low-dose compazine. People think the compazine dose is 25 or 12 and a half. Listen, start at 5. And so an olanzapine, or they can use the H1, you know, Phenergan-like drugs. So those are the best if you need to use an antiemetic. Most patients don't need an antiemetic. As far as cytopenias, the thrombocytopenia with niraparib still can happen. And so if I get a platelet count less than 100, even if it's 99, I stop. And then where the nadir settles out depends on what I do. If I stop at 99 and the nadir sort of is greater than 75, I might be able to go back at the 200 or 300 dose. But if the nadir of the thrombocytopenia is less than 75, you should always dose reduce. As far as transfusions, we give every patient on a PARP inhibitor multivitamin, which includes B12, iron, and folate. Most anemias are not deficiency-related anemias, but you know, we just take that off the table. And then I'm okay to transfuse a patient maybe once or twice to maintain them on what I think is an adequate dose. But you really can't get to a transfusion-dependent patient. So I would transfuse her maybe once or twice. I would be, depending on the scenario, I don't have any problem with erythropoietin stimulating agents. Sometimes there's a challenge. So neutropenia, if there's persistent neutropenia or even persistent thrombocytopenia, I always have MDS on the back of my mind. And as you know, bone marrow biopsies are now done in IR. So it's so much easier than the, remember those days where you did it in the clinic and it was terrible. So we have no hesitation. We have hematologists right next door, and we always have that on our minds.
I was going to ask you about MDS. I feel like I hear more about it related to olaparib, but I wonder if that's just because there's more data there. Any reason to think, first of all, any reason to think there'd be any difference in terms of risk of MDS with the different PARP inhibitors? And where are we today with that? It looked like SOLO-1 was much less of a problem than the earlier trials like SOLO-2. Is it your impression that using it in a primary upfront setting, it's not going to be a gigantic issue?
It is. That's correct. I think the reason SOLO-2, I think, was close to 8% is because they got lots of platinum. So the AML-MDS is not only related to PARP, but it's related to, obviously, platinum as well.
Another thing that you mentioned, then I want to ask you about a couple other final things, is I hadn't heard the idea of the catechol stimulation with niraparib. I knew it, you know, was associated with hypertension. But is it like a coffee thing? You take the niraparib and you get like a kind of a stimulation?
It's at the cellular level. So it is a reuptake inhibition. And it's very well described. So you have more, you know what the catecholamines are, more in the system at the adrenergic receptors and all aspects of adrenergic surge. So hypertension, jitteriness, insomnia, all of that. And it's about 10%. Sort of the earliest detection is insomnia and hypertension. There are some patients, again, early on that just have hypertension, but it's real. And that would be a reason to me that is to switch to the other PARP inhibitor. If I was struggling, let's say with niraparib because of that, and there was another indication, let's say of olaparib in that same setting, I would switch.
Any comments about ovary seems to be pretty late to the game in terms of immunotherapy and checkpoint inhibitors. And one of the strategies that we're seeing in trials that are going on right now is adding a PARP inhibitor to an IO. and we just have very early data right now. Any thoughts about that strategy and whether you think it's going to pan out?
Yeah, so there's a podcast for the British Medical Journal sponsored by the International Gynecologic Cancer Society about Javelin 200 and Javelin 100 and how we failed adding avelumab to frontline chemotherapy and also liposomal doxorubicin. And I couldn't even help myself from getting into Imagine 50 where atezolizumab and bevacizumab failed in frontline. I think that this idea that PARP and IO rather than chemotherapy IO or Bev and IO is going to be the answer is not as optimistic as we used to be. And I reviewed on my slide deck sort of the studies that are ongoing. Those studies, though, are very different. They're different. The control arm is niraparib. Bevacizumab is required in some, is elective in the other. The endpoints are sort of different. Some is all comers, some is HRD. So I think, you know, since we're going to have five shots on goal, we'll probably hit one of them. But I don't think this is going to be the situation where platinum sensitive relapse, right? PARP, Aerial 3, Nova, Study 19s, everyone works. Same thing with bevacizumab, right? Oceans, 218, 213, Aurelia, all you have to do is a study with bevacizumab and it works. I don't think that's going to be the case. And that's why I didn't go over Mediola and some of these small phase twos, because we have 5,000 patients randomized, which you're going to report within a year to figure it out. So we'll have to see. And I PI one of them.
So a couple other things in terms of new research directions in ovarian cancer. One of the things you talked about in your talk was antibody drug conjugates. This has been a really wild fall for antibody drug conjugates and other tumors. We're about to see it ASH. The first, of course, we saw tisotumab approved in cervical cancer, of course. At ASH, there's going to be a presentation for the first time in I don't know how long. There's going to be, it looks like there's a positive upfront trial in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Has an antibody drug conjugate added in.
Yeah.
In breast cancer, the two anti-HER2 antibody drug conjugates, TDM1, TDXD, super, super effective. But also in ovarian cancer, I've been hearing about mirvetuximab for a while. I want you to update me on that. But also you were talking about a new one, UpRi, a new target, which is NABI2B. So what about mirvetuximab and this new one? And what about antibody drug conjugates in general in ovarian cancer?
So I really think that they've leapfrogged IO as the next best great thing, right? So we used to say, oh, it was, you know, anti-angiogenic, PARP, and then IO, and then IO sort of went away. We'll see and keep pushing. But antibody drug conjugates are exciting. Let me tell you why antibody drug conjugates are exciting, is because they can shrink tumors. And when you can shrink tumors, then you can enroll 100 patients and show, oh, the tumor shrank, and that's better than available therapy. And with an acceptable duration of response and adverse reaction profile, you can get accelerated approval. And that's what we did, right, in cervical cancer. And so mirvetuximab, surventansine, that's what they're trying to do. I'm pretty confident of that. UpRi NAPI2B is a sodium phosphate transport channel. It's a very good tumor antigen, and they're doing a single-arm phase two as well. Now, as you know, with these dangling accelerated approvals, you have to have the sort of the phase three substantially enrolled, and that's okay. But I like that. See, when it comes to tumor treating fields, you can't shrink tumors. So now you got to do a 540 patient randomized trial with paclitaxel. There's a VB111, a gene therapy added to weekly paclitaxel. Again, you can't shrink tumors. There's also this AXL decoy, GAS6, okay? And again, you can't shrink tumors. So when you can't shrink tumors, then you have to do these randomized trials, sort out the relative contribution, and the landscape is constantly changing. But antibody drug conjugates can shrink tumors. And when you can do that with just 100 patients, you can get accelerated approval. And that's really why I do what I do. You know, I only do clinical trials to get FDA approval. It's the only reason. And if it doesn't get FDA approval and doesn't get in the clinic and doesn't give you as our listeners the opportunity to use it, I have not succeeded. So that's when I get, when, you know, if we get an accelerated approval, and all the PARP inhibitors came to market and through this accelerated approval mechanism. And so we're hoping to have antibody drug conjugates. And the SORAYA trial, and Rob Coleman has a very lucky rabbit's foot. He's the PI of that. And he was also the PI of the tisotumab vedotin accelerated approval. And it's trust me, it's not luck. It's skill. He's a very skilled clinical trialist.
So you mentioned Tumor Treating Fields, and I can remember we used to go to the Society of Neuro-Oncology when we first brought up Tumor Treating Fields and glioblastoma, and everybody in the room was like, whoa, what is that?
Exactly.
I've always thought it was fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about sort of what the pathophysiology or the basis of Tumor Treating Fields is, how it's done, and where you think it's heading in ovarian cancer?
Yeah, so these are arrays. So it's a sticker, if you will, with metal embedded in the adhesive. You attach it to the body and you put it over the area where the cancer is of greatest concern. Obviously, you can't put it everywhere. And the fields alternate. They alternate back and forth. And as they do that, they interfere with the polarity of the cells, the mitotic spindle complexes, and interfere with cell division. And it's a sort of an intermediate 350 to 500 kilohertz on the electromagnetic field. There's no skin burning, maybe a little warmth, but nothing to worry about. And they work not only in glioblastoma multiforme, but thoracic mesothelioma. And they have a broad development plan. And the challenge is you can't shrink tumors to a substantial degree. They're more complementary, at least in ovarian cancer, although they're used as single agents in thoracic mesothelioma and glioblastoma. So we've completed a 540-patient randomized trial of weekly paclitaxel, which is also a spindle poison, with Tumor Treating Fields. And they are applied. They have some challenges because some of us get sort of allergic reactions to adhesives, but they're very well tolerated, and it really is a wonderful opportunity, I think, for patients. And we're going to know soon. I mean, that study is, the results are anticipated. There is some analyses that are embedded into the statistical analysis plan that are probably not in the public domain that should ideally give us some answers in the short term.
Do you have any sense from just using, I assume you've had patients be treated that way
yourself? Yeah.
How do patients respond to it? I know in GBM, some of them felt like a little bit of a hassle. And do you have any sense at all? I know it's hard to tell. I don't even know. Obviously, it's not blinded. About efficacy, do you think it's going to be positive?
I can't say. And in these open label, single arm phase twos, like UpRi, like mirvetuximab, I know when the patient's getting that. If they're on the study. And you look at the CAT scan and go, oh, tumor's gone. So it has to be the agent. But when you add it to an active agent like weekly paclitaxel, it's impossible for me to say. I can only speak to the tolerability. And we use some corticosteroid cream or ointment depending on it, sometimes even a Medrol pack if the rash is severe. It's all I can speak to. But we're going to know soon. And we failed many times in platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer. Most times. Sometimes called the graveyard of drug development. So it'll be interesting, if it were not for, it was liposomal doxorubicin and topotecan in the, 15 years ago, and then bevacizumab, and that's it. That and gemcitabine didn't even get FDA approved. So we'll have to see. I'm excited. I want this to be available for my patients, but obviously only if it works.
So two final quick questions for you. First, just kind of curious, we were thinking about the, we've been kind of thinking about the idea of doing oncology CME for non-oncology physicians. And I was just curious because one of the groups that we were thinking about is the benign gynecologists. Gynecologists are in the community who don't do gynecologic oncology. My sense is, even though there have been such dramatic developments in ovarian cancer, particularly the PARP inhibitors, I'm not sure exactly how much it's gotten penetrated into that community. They have so many other things going on. Any sense about whether there's a need or interest to educate the rest of the gynecologic community about ovarian cancer?
Sort of three opportunities. Number one is I think we can always educate the gynecologist sort of what ovarian cancer looks like ultrasonographically or from a tumor marker perspective, and what the appropriate referral is to a gynecologic oncologist. I don't think that they really have a handle on that. They tend to read the words on the ultrasound or CAT scan and believe it rather than integrate the decision-making process. That's number one. Number two, really the cure of ovarian cancer is identifying women with genetic mutations and doing risk-reducing surgery. So they see way more women than we could ever see, and they just need to learn how to get germline testing, and they do. Most of my risk-reducing patients now are from the OBGYN community, interestingly. It used to be the, you know, the med onc, you know, had the sister with breast cancer, something like that. And then third, the primary care physicians who really are key to the supportive care platform really have no idea. So let's say that a patient has nausea from an oral anti-cancer therapy, whether it's lenvatinib or PARP inhibitor or anything, TKI, they don't know what antiemetic to use. In fact, they're probably using the ones they shouldn't use, which is called ondansetron. And they don't know that if you have an anti-VEGF-related hypertension and you don't fix it, that they may have a seizure. So I think those are the sorts of, you know, topics that we could do for the primary care providers. So number one, triage of adnexal masses. Two, testing the appropriate patients for hereditary genes. And then three, the primary care physician, how to manage the supportive care, because they end up there. And, you know, thyroid disease. Do the primary care doctors know how to handle, you know, hypothyroidism from a checkpoint? They probably never even heard of it. Or hypertension from an antiangiogenic. And these are really, really like 35% of patients. So these are not rare adverse reactions. These are things that the primary care community wants to hear about.
One final question. You were mentioning the GOG Foundation, and I know there are a lot of groups that have foundations. Do they actually try to, are they actually trying to, you know, go out and seek funding from donors? Is that an important thing they do?
It is. Philanthropy. It is. So the GOG Foundation has two arms. It has NRG, CTEP, and GOG Partners. And I worked on the NRG team for many years, chaired the Cervical Cancer Committee for 11 years, but I'm basically, you know, GOG Partners. And so we create strategy. So they'll, mirvetuximab will come to us, or UPRI, and say, look, Tumor Treating Fields, all of these say, you know, hold an ad board, tell us what to do. And then we work with them to get that, whether it's an FDA interaction. And then we work in this, in the site management organization to help select sites and keep people on track. And then we educate what we're doing here. Our philanthropy is challenging because Ohio State and Memorial Sloan Kettering want you to give patients to them, to the university. So we have been slow to build that out for that very reason. We have not wanted to compete against our friends that work at Duke and Memorial and these wonderful Washington University in St. Louis. But over time, we've realized that the community practices, such as US Oncology, we don't have a university or a cancer center to give money to. So we are in the process of building that out. In its current iteration, although it was founded sort of by me in 2010, the current version of GOG Partners is only 4 years old, even though we're up to our 70th trial. So we're building it out. We have a wonderful team. We have great culture and energy, and that's, we're working on it. We do have a website. On our website, patients can have an opportunity, but we, that's something that needs to be expanded.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Monk, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.